character is Ian McCarrick, who you may know was supposed to join us last week. He was unfortunately not able to make it, and he was very nice in being able to come back to see us this week on Fresh Air. He's known around the world for his ecological approach to landscape architecture and urban planning. Many people have been introduced to his ideas through his book Design with Nature, which was first published in 1969. It's largely because of his philosophy that landscape design has gone beyond the pretty bushes and flowers decorative approach to a field that addresses the larger environmental and ecological issues. McCarrick is now the chairman of the Department of Landscape Architecture and Regional Planning at the University of Pennsylvania. His work can be seen in many different places around this country and other parts of the world. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I wonder if you grew up in Scotland.
Yes.
And I wonder if there was something about the environment there, about the place where you grew up, that led to, in some way, the philosophy that you developed.
I don't know if it led to the philosophy. It certainly led to a confrontation of a problem. Because the two opposites were so immediately visible. I was born about 10 miles away from Glasgow in the foothills of the Ochilpatrick Hills, which is in the north side of the Clyde, so that from my parents' bedroom window I could look down to the Clyde and see the forests of Derricks, from which came, of course, the Queen Elizabeth, the Empress of Britain, the Lusitania, the Aquitania, the Mauritania, all the great ships in the world were built there. And if I looked out of my own bedroom window, I could see then not only the foothills of the Ochilpatricks, but the Campsies and the Ochils. And there's just a whole succession of purple hills. And these, because there's no law of trespass in Scotland, it's a wonderful country for this condition alone. It was possible for boys to go into the countryside very, very easily, which I did, you know, successfully, father and father. And I found it absolutely enchanting. I found it very, very moving. It's a very spare country and a very poor country and perhaps even a very hard country, but it's a very beautiful one. I mean, the purple heather hills, the bracken, the trees in the valleys, the farmlands, and, of course, the sea and very, very powerful and beautiful rivers. And, of course, in the other direction was Glasgow. And it was perfectly visible, you see. I could really see these things within, 360 degrees. And Glasgow was always a plume of sulfur smoke. And the nearer one got to Glasgow, the more really obscene it was. Four-story walk-up apartments, which had been built of sandstone, were covered with grime. And there seemed to be no sunlight whatsoever. And, of course, these great industries, the Colville plant, which is, you know, Turner-esque skies and so on. But there's always a sense of smoke and dirt and crime and somehow meanness. And on the one hand, although the people were goodly people, you know, with a great generosity and warmth and a marvellous kind of deprecation about themselves and others, But still, there was a meanness in all of this environment. And the landscape itself was so absolutely grand. It was moving and it was beautiful. It was very, very simple, very powerful, and perhaps even a little fearful. But it was movingly beautiful and had no meanness at all. And I had great difficulty with, you know, dealing with these two things. Here was a given landscape so beautiful, and here were the artifacts of men so oppressive and mean and diminishing.
When you began to study landscape design and architecture, did you feel that there were great mistakes that had been made that demanded that the whole approach be rethought?
Well, you know, you didn't have to be very intelligent to understand that the city had always been the repository of the most civilized, cultivated, and urbane people and all their institutions. I mean, the very words themselves say that, you know, civis, city, civilized, herbs, urbane, city, polis, you know, city-state, polite. And but the Industrial Revolution, of course, had transformed the city from being the focus and the expression of all that was cultivated and valued by society into a really an oppressive, city of bondage to toil, Blake's Dark Satanic Mills. So, to retrieve the city wasn't a matter of inventing it again, because cities until the 19th century had been delightful places, and where there are pre-Industrial Revolution cities in the world, they are still delightful. So it didn't require any invention at all. It simply required some set of values which gave supremacy to the human environment as opposed to the industrial environment. So I was intent on making some modest contribution to this.
What were those values that you thought we needed to bring to design?
Oh, well, I think, you know, the opposition is easier. If poor farmers and poor country people and people in small villages who were indistinguishably poor from the people in the cities could have live a life at least not inhibited, diminished by the environment which they inhabited, then surely it must also be possible to have cities which are equally humane. And then, of course, the evidence of medieval cities, which I could visit after all. Edinburgh has a very large medieval component, which really was humane. I don't think anybody suffered a diminution of spirit because of living in the medieval environment. And, of course, there was the 18th century city in Edinburgh, which was absolutely resplendent, you know, with a marvelous system of open space and wonderful buildings by Adams and Playfair. So it became quite evident. I mean, one didn't have to be very clever to observe that the countryside and country villages were perfectly humane, and that medieval and 18th century cities were also more than humane. And so surely one didn't have always to live with the oppression to the human spirit represented by the 19th century industrial city.
So you felt that we had to bring into the city more of the natural environment?
Well, I think more than that. There was an oppression to the spirit caused by the buildings, too. You know, four-story walk-up tenements in any environment are really not, you know, enlarging to the human spirit. I think there's simply a hierarchy of values in which the primacy was given to industry and to commerce, and the human environment really took what was left. Actually, that's not how I get into landscape. I mean, I know that I thought about these matters, but the idea that one could positively intervene was a revelation to me. It happened because during the Depression, I was unhappy about being 6'2", 16 years of age, and dependent. And I was the oldest son of a family with two boys and two girls. And my father, who had a splendid job as a manager of a factory making diesel engines for ships, was unemployed. And so I decided I have to do something. I first tried to become a cadet officer aboard the Cunard Line, and my father wouldn't allow me to do this and sent me back to high school. And then I heard about something called the Glasgow Careers Council, and I went to see a splendid man whom I'll never forget called Mitchell, who observed that I had a pretty good transcript, but I also did drawing and painting. I'd won quite a lot of prizes for this. And he said, "This is a somewhat unusual combination. Have you ever thought of landscape architecture?" Which I'd never heard of. He said, "There is one landscape architect in Scotland, and I know him. His name is Donald Wintersgill, and I'll arrange for you to have an interview with him." So I spoke to Mr. Wintersgill, and he said, yes, he'd be interested. If I could get my parents' permission, I could go with him the weekend. He was going to northwestern Scotland, and I could accompany him and see what a landscape architect did. The place he went to was Glenlivet, and people who drink Scotch whiskey know that Glenlivet is a whiskey. And this distillery was owned by a man then called Captain Grant, and Captain Grant had a large labour force who only worked periodically, and he was intent on using them productively during the whole of the year as he paid them. And so he called Wintersgill to decide what to do with this impoverished land. He had tens, if not hundreds, of square miles of barren land with nothing growing on it but bracken and heather. And so Wintersgill, with me accompanying him, met Captain Grant, and we drove up in a shooting break, and we came to a point where we could see the largest part of the landscape. And Wintersgill then, in it with an English accent, which I can't replicate, moved his walking stick and depicted a line of hills, and he said, "I think we'll clothe these. We'll put forest in all these ones there. But then the drumlins in the front," he said, "I think we'll leave these in heather and bracken. But," he said, "I think there should be some planting along the stream. And there," he said, "I think there's a grand place for a lake. We'll just put a lake right there in the foreground." And he said, your tenants are scattered around." He said, "They should be in a village. At least there should be an option. There's a lovely sheltered place there by the side of the stream," and so on, so on, so on, so on. And, you know, I was absolutely overwhelmed that some man with a walking stick could absolutely transform a landscape before your eyes. And, of course, he did. This is done. I mean, I have seen it. There are rainforests where there were bare, denuded hills, which had been deforested in 1745. The whole landscape was transformed. So I was assured by him it was possible for a person to actually make a livelihood doing this, and I was just absolutely transported.
If you met that same man today and he said, "Well, see, we'll put the lake here and we'll get rid of the forest and we'll put trees where the heather is," what would you say to him?
No, I think he was, in fact, a precursor ecologist. He actually knew the social history of Scotland very well, and much of that land had been in forest. It was cut down, you know, after the English success in the Second Jacobite Rebellion, and it was so precarious, you see, it was so north, it was so near to tundra and taiga, that it would have taken a long time naturally. As a matter of fact, it might never have returned because the introduction of sheep soured the land and probably arrested the regeneration. And so he was actually acting as an agent to accomplish regeneration of landscape, which had been impoverished by man's acts. Now, I think today one would do it with more science than he employed, but nonetheless, he accomplished a great deal with a small amount of knowledge and a good amount of art.
There are many landscapes, and I'm thinking particularly of like new universities in which mm-hmm. there are lakes that are dug out in places where there's not necessarily enough natural water to fill it, and the physical landscape is appreciably altered to mm-hmm. suit the aesthetics yes. of the architect's plans. What do you think of that approach?
No, I think today we have a far richer scientific knowledge, which would allow us, confronting a problem of this sort, to, you know, analyze the geology and the hydrology and the meteorology and the soils and the plants and the animals and so on, and find out something about the natural history and processes of succession. On the basis of this understanding, you could intervene in these systems. You know, you could either help to accomplish regeneration or you could modify it. But you would do it as a modification of a natural system rather than the introduction of an entirely new and foreign system.
Yeah, so to what extent is intervening okay, and to what extent is intervening, like, what's going too far when you're intervening with the natural landscape?
Well, I think just so long as the proposition is that you are intent on modifying a system which has its own destiny. That is, you know, if we abandon the city of Philadelphia right now, closed it down, it would return to forest. It's only a matter of time. The kind of forest that we return to would be somewhat different than the primeval forest, only because we've introduced so many exotic plants, which many of which would actually survive. But I think if the landscape architect understands that the system he lives in actually has a destiny of its own, left its own devices, it will evolve, whether it's prairie, savanna, you know, delta, whatever it is. And a landscape architect really is modifying a system rather than creating one. And you can modify. I mean, if you like dogwoods, then you have to clear some light in the forest, right? And if you clear, if there's light in the forest around here, then you get dogwoods or volunteer. So you can modify the environment in order to make it propitious for the plants that you wish to occupy it. And I think that's perfectly all right.
How do you define the role of the landscape architect?
Oh, there's so many definitions. One of the most grandiloquent I coined myself at a time when nobody cared about landscape architecture. The professional professional conscience of society for the acts of man to nature. You know, that you can only make a definition like that when nobody cares a hoot about the subject.
When you were first articulating your philosophy, it was, well, Design with Nature was published in 1969. Yeah. That was right before there was a strong ecology movement in this country. What type of reaction did you get to your views?
Oh, I think you have to go back a little bit farther. When I came here, I came in 1954 to the University of Pennsylvania to set up a Department of Landscape Architecture. There had been one before, but it died in 1942. At that time, there really was no interest in the environment whatsoever. And even my, you know, close friends who were architects and city planners were very patronizing to the landscape. The assumption was it was a social world and that, you know, social events were determined by prior social events. It wasn't a natural world. There were no physical processes or biological processes which were thought to be consequential. And so I really had a rather sad time of it, trying to interest people in the subject. As a matter of fact, the only people who ever asked me to speak were garden clubs. And they would rather have had me speak about petunias and, you know, dogwoods and so on than the environment. But we had a little arrangement that I would address their problem for some of the time, but I would like them to listen to my conception of the problem some of the time, too. So when Design with Nature was written, my expectations were that we'd be very lucky if we sold 5,000 copies. As a matter of fact, I printed it, and we operated on the assumption I could pay all costs and make no money whatsoever if it sold 5,000 copies. And, of course, I think it sold something like, you know, 100,000 copies the first year, some, you know, success, phantasmagorical. Because somehow, you know, the young people decided the environment really was a consequential subject, and there was this great tidal surge. For me, of course, the whole transformation was epitomized by the greatest Earth Day, which was held in the United States, which was in Philadelphia, for 10 years ago, when we mobilized 30,000 people in Belmont Plateau, the culmination of this great week of celebration, in which everybody who amounted to anything in the environmental field was in Philadelphia and spoke. But this very last day with Muskie and George Wald and Herbert the Dunes and Ginsberg and all sorts of other people, and 30,000 people who at the end of that day picked up every single piece of litter from Belmont Plateau and who walked back to town carrying candles and singing. That was a wonderfully moving day.
How did your peers, both in the academic setting and in architecture, react to you after the ecology movement, after the success of Earth Day?
No great change, in fact. Architecture has a quite modern architecture has a very profound anti-natural component, you know. All of the great gods of architecture, Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier, Gropius, and so on, really did believe that landscape was the sort of backdrop, that the architecture really was the statement, the human statement, and that nature was all very well as something to reflect in windows or something to be a backdrop. And Ezra Stoller always carried around, an architectural photographer, all of us carried around a twig with leaves to hang in front of the lens. But there really was no great sympathy for architecture, and by and large, I don't think there has been a great change.
Can you give us an example of an environment, preferably an urban environment, that you think really succeeds well in integrating the architecture with the landscape and in being a good environment for people to work and live within?
You know, it's awfully hard to make that so simply. A larger statement is it's almost all vernacular architecture in all countries in the world satisfies us. That is, you know, if you go to all of the islands in Greece, you go to the mountain villages of Italy, you go to farmsteads in Pennsylvania. Wherever you go, if you find pre-industrial architecture, the fact of the matter is the people who built this were empiricists. They weren't interested in expressing high styles. They were interested in understanding about the climate and soils and rocks and plants and animals and views. And they cared a good deal about using available materials, learning how to use them well. They cared about things like heat and cold and keeping warm and keeping animals warm and so on. And they weren't engaged in making great metaphysical statements. They were engaged in the empirical business of learning how to build well in order to protect themselves and enhance their lives. And so wherever you go, I mean, any country in the world, you look at vernacular, non-high-style architecture, and the chances are very, very good you're going to see this kind of harmony. Now, of course, there are mistakes, but these are the exception rather than the rule. And so when architectural students graduate and win prizes, of course, they don't go around the world looking at modern architecture, at least rarely. What they do is they look at, you know, they go to Greece, they go to Kos and Leros and Patmos and Mykonos and so on, and they go to the hill villages of the south of Italy or the north of Italy, and, they make their way into Germany and Holland and England. And they're absolutely enchanted with this empirical architecture, you see, which really was doing just exactly what you're saying.
Of course, we are in an industrial age, and there's no way around that now.
No, that's right. But the lessons are still there to be learned, and I think you see there's a different attitude. Whereas the empiricists didn't know, the Amish farmer didn't know about bedrock geology or geomorphology or meteorology or anything of the sort, but he was a very, very observant person, as were his parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, and they accumulated a good deal of common wisdom about the things that you had to know in order to be able to live, build, and farm in a particular piece of ground. Now, you know, we have built asphalt men who know nothing about this whatsoever, but of course we have science, which is occupied by lots of people who know a good deal about this. However, such information generally doesn't get itself into the planning process. Planning for so long was really thought to be applied economics or applied sociology, and there were no biophysical scientists in the planning process. One of the things I did at the University of Pennsylvania, thanks to the Ford Foundation, was for the first time anywhere to recruit biophysical scientists and make planners of them. So, you know, we can't get back to this empiricism. It takes too long, and we don't need to wait that long. I mean, there is all of the intelligence that we need to know reposing in depositories, libraries, and in people's minds now. The only thing we need to do is to collect these people and ask them to engage with us in planning humane environments.
How can some of this be applied to older urban areas?
Oh, I don't think it makes any difference, you see. Geology applies wherever you are. If you live in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, it matters a good deal the formation upon which you sit has a good deal of uranium in it, you know, because that will show up in epidemiology, show up in pathology. It matters a good deal here in urban areas, whether you live in the Philadelphia side of the metropolitan region or the New Jersey side, because almost all the natural factors which matter vary from side to side in the river. One side is in the crystalline Piedmont, and the other side is the coastal plain. One, you know, has rocks on or near the surface. You can see, as you drive along the West River and East River Drive, you can see the rocks, and then they disappear and they don't reappear, you see. They're covered with marine sediments all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. And so the environments in the metropolitan region are very, very, very diverse, and people have to know about this. It isn't an accident. The people who repair or try to repair wet basements do most of their building in New Jersey. That's the coastal plain. You're going to get wet basements if the seasonal high water table is on or near the surface, which is most everywhere there. Whereas in the crystalline Piedmont, the Philadelphia side, you know, there isn't very much business with wet basements because in rock you don't have seasonal high water table very near the surface. Sadly, you see, education doesn't tell people how the world works. And the natural sciences somehow are thought to be the province of only people who are, you know, preoccupied with academic science. Of course, the opposite was always true, that, you know, ordinary village and farming people cared a good deal about the natural sciences. That was the world they lived in. They had to know about it because such knowledge was a precondition for success. Urban man is operating on the assumption he doesn't have to know this because he lives in a social world, which is biophysical, but that's not true. They're just different animals you have to care about. I mean, rice and rats and starlings and so on, cockroaches, you know, these are important urban animals, but still, they've got to be dealt with in terms of animal ecology. The plant vocabulary in the city is going to be different too, but one still lives in a world where plants are rather important, not least, of course, one's intestinal flora.
When you are doing an ecological study, and you've done many of those in this country as well as countries as far away as Nigeria, what are the questions you have to ask? What are the things that you have to look for before any designing is done?
Right. Well, it sounds such a simple answer, but the question you want to ask is what is the system and how does it work? And, of course, there's no one single person can answer that. And over a long period of times, I've devised a very, very simple method, which requires you to bring in a selected group of environmental scientists in succession using chronology to help you understand reality. So you start with the oldest evidence first, and the oldest evidence generally is going to be geology, so that here the rocks are 500 million years old. So you get the oldest information because it's the most consequential. It affects everything else. And the bedrock geology is the first thing you put down. And then the surficial geology, the geology of the Pleistocene, which isn't terribly remarkable here, but it's very, very remarkable just a little farther north of us where, you know, great glaciers. A glacier, I think 5 miles thick, was lying in half of Staten Island. And the consequence of that, of course, are still visible. Surficial geology is next. And then you reinterpret bedrock and surficial geology as groundwater hydrology. I mean, if you live where I live, it's hard to get water from the ground because the crystalline rocks don't hold very much water. If you go to New Jersey, southern New Jersey, it's almost impossible to find a place where you can't get copious quantities of water. So hydrology is variable, but it's variable with respect to geology and geological history. So then you reinterpret the expressed bedrock and the superficial geology in terms of physiography. That explains why there are high places, low places, deltas, escarpments, and so on. So you see, every layer is causal and allows you to explain every other layer. So after you've got geomorphology or physiography or topography, then you put the soils on top of that, and they're causally related. They're derived from the bedrock or glacial action. And these then produce habitats for plants or environments for plants, which produce habitats then for animals, which you see also, this same natural history produces resources for people, whether it's bog iron or real iron or bauxite or petroleum or your coal or transportation corridors or places where you can ford rivers, whatever it is. So then you see, once you understand this natural system, then you reinterpret the natural system for its implications and consequences to human habitation over time. So then you do an ethnographic history. You've got this natural system in which it's a descriptive and to some extent predictive model of an interacting biophysical system, comprehensible through history, you know, time and laws. And then you begin to populate it with people. And the model, developed by my anthropological colleagues at the university, is that a natural system also has resources. But a resource is a function of the perception of the observer. I mean, you've got to know that you can do something with uranium before it becomes a resource. The Indians didn't, happily for them. But once you perceive something is a resource, the resource or resources locate the means of production. Then the means of production selects people who can do it. That is, when you had to mine coal in North America, there were nobody around who knew how to mine coal, but Scotsmen, you know, had naturally gravitated to this depraved occupation and knew a good deal about it. So the first coal miners were Scotsmen. So we tend to find in American history that people who came over had not only occupational identities, they had religious identities, ethnic identities, religious, occupational, and ultimately also spatial identities. And they brought with them a characteristic settlement pattern, and they brought with them characteristic institutions. And so you begin to see, by this analysis, there is a homogeneity, there is a systematic relationship between the people and the place. And given their attitude and their means of production, they're going to have characteristic, not only institutions, but values. You know, that they wish to perpetuate themselves and the quality of their life and so on. So I think this great leap of seeing that natural systems really are in fact systematic and they can be affected profoundly by man, and they also have profound effects upon his well-being, but that there is a systematic relationship between man and nature, that I think is a great leap and a very new one.
So how will you use that after you've done an ecological study? How should it be used and what would be violating your findings?
Well, no, the violation is... we've got to jump through You've got to abandon the violation at the moment. First of all, when you have the system, you see, you've now got the best description available about how this system works. And so then you can ask the system, where is a good place or where is a bad place? You know, somebody comes to me, George Mitchell, and says, Ian, I want to build a new city of 20, you know, I need to have 20,000 acres. I've got 80,000, I want you to select 20,000 acres as the most propitious. And it's going to have, you know, residential by type and industrial and commercial and so on and so on and so on. Find me good places. Now, if he can define good, that is what constitutes the best possible environment for high density residential, intermediate and low density, recreation by type, urbanization by commercial by type. If we can identify all the factors that are propitious, some of which are money values, others of which are not, and he can identify all the detrimental ones, I can write a program asking my data to find those areas where all or most of the propitious factors exist and none or few of the detrimental ones do, which case that area is then most fit. Now, the question of violations is very much a question of values. That is, in any region, if there's any allocation of resources, there'll be people with conflicting value systems so that somebody's going to suffer and somebody's going to benefit. When I do professional work, I try not to take a personal position on this evaluation. I operate an assumption that it's comprehensible that different people are likely to have different values, and what the responsibility of the planner is to show what the implications are of any action. If you build an atomic reactor or a sewage treatment plant or a highway or a transmission line, whatever it is, who suffers and who benefits is something we can demonstrate. But you see, society decides, it's not the planner.
There's always the ideal when you're working in something, the ideal that you work for and the values that you're working with. But then there's the parameters that you have to work within, the resources that you have, the money that's available, the amount of time that you have, the manpower. Do the two frequently come together for you so that you have the resources available to you so that you can work in support of your values? Or do you sometimes have to sacrifice some of your values because of the limited resources and the limited amount of time that's available?
Well, I have to answer that in an oblique way, that I see myself as operating different roles. One, I'm a shameless propagandist for the environment. I mean, I give polemic lectures regularly all around the country, which I express my own values, and I do it in a very, very outspoken way. However, when I teach here, I don't think it's appropriate for me to be a polemicist, and I absolutely never am a polemicist when I actually practice. That is, my moral decision hinges upon whether or not I will subscribe to the client's values. And there are some clients who, you know, the Department of Defense I would not work for, IT&T I would not work for, and I've told these people I couldn't possibly. But there are people whose values I do subscribe to, at which point I then suppress my own value system and utilize theirs. I'm then providing services to them for money, and it's appropriate that I then am responsive to their value system. So after that, then, it may very well be that different constituencies within the area being planned have different value systems, in which case it seems to me my moral obligation to show that they do have different value systems, and what benefit and what cost will be incurred by any intervention to each one of these groups of people. And, of course, if we can go further than that, and if they see that most of the people, in fact, are going to get more benefits and costs, then it behoves them to see what adjustments they have to make to their own value systems, concessions to each other, so that in sum, all of them derive the benefits which this particular intervention may provide.
Ian McCarg is my guest, if you're just joining us. You said that there's some people who you wouldn't work for, and included IT&T in there. A few years ago, you began work on an environmental park in Iran, and that was at the time when the Shah was in power. I know a lot of people felt that it was a time when one should not work for the Shah because of his very repressive regime. What did you think about when deciding to take on that project?
Yes, that was a very troublesome thing. And as a matter of fact, somebody wrote a rather nasty letter about me in the Daily Pennsylvania, which hurt me. To which I replied, obviously the situation is clear. Here I am, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, ostensible liberal, working for the Shah of Iran. And, of course, I had never thought of myself as working for the Shah of Iran. The client, in fact, was an inspired fellow, now in prison, who was a Yale-trained civil engineer who had come under the influence of a distinguished ecologist at Yale, who had, without doubt, the most challenging vision I have ever encountered in my whole life. And my sense was that the person I was serving was this man and his dream, and not the Shah. I never met the Shah. At the same time, I had to deal with the fact that the Shah was a very unpleasant fellow and things that were going on in Iran were rather unpleasant. But at the same time, of course, things that were going on in the United States were rather unpleasant too. And I had a very low opinion of Nixon, a very low opinion of Kissinger. I had a very bad opinion of the Department of Defense and a worse opinion of the CIA. And so I had to come to terms with the fact that my own government displeased me in a very, very profound way too. And make the moral judgment, if there were good people in any country who were trying to do good things, I would associate with them. It certainly was not a wise decision because I suffered profoundly financially as a result of this calamity. But nonetheless, it was quite the most inspired project I've ever heard of or ever been associated with.
Can you give us a brief idea of the project?
Well, this man became the minister, first the minister of the environment in Iran. And he recognized immediately there would have to be a post-oil economy for Iran, and this would have to be found in the environment. The next thing he observed was the scientific community in Iran was puny. As a matter of fact, smaller than the scientific community in my department. And so he couldn't diffuse his scientific resources around the country the way we can. I mean, we have EPA regional offices and so on. He couldn't possibly do this. His community was too small. The advantages he confronted were that there were no established institutions. One of the great problems we have here is there are a plethora of institutions which do not cooperate. There, in fact, is nobody looking after the United States, but there are lots of agencies, public and private, which are, in fact, engaged with one or another aspect, the USDA and Interior Department, Smithsonian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at least he didn't have the impediment of a lot of established institutions. And so his mandate was he would like to set up a single institution devoted to educating, undertaking research, and managing the Iranian environment, to do which he thought he could make into one institution the entities which would usually occur independently as an Academy of Natural Sciences, a Museum of Natural History, a Botanical Garden, a Zoological Garden, an Aquarium, and a Planetarium. And these were to be one institutions which were to be, in fact, the brains. And this institution was going to be in this great botanical zoological garden. It was actually going to be there with all the research capability. And the environmental part was structured in a way which replicated each of the physiographic and sociocultural regions of Iran, actually physically replicated them, the ground. And the idea was that each one of the environmental problems confronted with each one of these regions would have a group of scientists addressing that particular problem who, on finding a solution, would apply the problem to a pilot in the real world. Right. And then the results of this would be part of a continuing education program in this park called Partizan. And this reciprocal relationship between the scientists and the people actually in the environment. And it was thought to be very utilitarian. I mean, for instance, cretinism is very common in parts of Iran, and it derives from eating the food or milk or cheese from animals which eat one shrub, astragalus. And apparently this is not well identified, and the connection is not widely known. Now, it would not have been a terribly difficult problem, you see, to get people to be able to identify this, make sure that goats, sheep, onagers, camels, and so on did not eat it, or if they did eat it, they would not themselves be eaten. They could be used for breeding, but not for eating. There are a number of very, very widespread diseases and very, very rudimentary medical facilities in rural Iran. One of the things we thought we could do there was induce people to put their finger on something to get a blood sample from which we could do a blood test. It was thought really in terms of, the simplest kind of animal husbandry, the simplest kind of adaptation, and it was oriented not to high technology at all. It was oriented to really vernacular technologies which could be widely applied.
What happened when the Shah lost power and the Ayatollah took over? What kinds of connections did you have?
Well, during that period of time when it was clear the Shah was going to disappear, the whole bureaucracy, of course, became absolutely terrified, and they became very they made life very, very difficult for foreign contractors. I mean, they were unwilling to make any decisions lest the successive government would rebuke them for this. They're certainly unwilling to be even just to American contractors. And so this is a very, very difficult period. And, of course, life for our employees, we had an office in Tehran, life for our employees became absolutely intolerable, and we ultimately evacuated them, and the project, we thought, ended. But during the government of Bazargan, we found, in fact, they had not concluded that it was ended, and it looked as if this might be reviewed, and who knows, might, in fact, have continued. I think now it is probably too rich for the Iranian blood that their problems are much, much more fundamental than this, and I suspect it's very unlikely that this will ever come to be. And if it won't come to be there, I can't think of any place where it might come to be. This extraordinary set of circumstances of an inspired minister. I mean, one doesn't expect to find inspired politicians in any country. And this man was not a professional politician. He was an intellectual who had a very, very considerable amount of power and had a dream and had resources and was able to persuade people this was worthwhile doing. I don't expect ever again to find anybody quite so inspired and capable.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the culture of a place determines what you'll be doing with
it? Oh, absolutely. Well, the values are going to be a function of the culture. I don't know enough about Iran, but to be able to use very good examples there. Although, you know, Iran isn't a country, and I suppose it's a great illusion for all of us to assume it is a single country. I mean, the Shah was not called the King of Kings for nothing, because there are, in fact, a number of, the Kurds, the Baluchi, the Bakhtiari, and so on. These are provinces. These are independent cultures of antiquity with long-scale, long-term friendships and enmities and so on. But no, we need only look at our own environment. Clearly, if you're planning in an area of this part of Pennsylvania, even Chester County alone, you would expect that the attitudes to the environment would be very, very variable with respect to different cultural groups. I mean, in part of Chester County, where you have Quaker dairy farmers of English extraction, and then where you have Italian mushroom farmers who are neighbors, and then where you have DuPont-type executives and so on who are, into farming for tax purposes, and then a little farther on when you have Amish, and then where you have Pennsylvania Dutch. Each of these people have, in fact, a different way of perceiving the environment, a different way of using the environment. They have characteristic settlement patterns, and they've, institutions. They are really a whole cloth of people who, over time, have come to understand the environment, adapt to it, use it well, create institutions to perpetuate themselves. And this is, characteristic isn't random. Now, the same is true in Philadelphia, you see. I think the same kind of analysis would show that the people of Manayunk really are discrete, and the people in Manayunk could draw a line defining Manayunk and defining themselves as mostly Polish and Catholic and Republican. And the people of Roxburgh could do too, and certainly true of Kensington and Richmond and Torresdale and so on. Each one of these are, to some extent, discrete communities in which the people have a very strong sense of their own identity, and they have characteristic values, and some of these are comprehensible in historical terms.
These are communities that grew up pretty organically. You designed one new town. What were some of the things that you thought would be essential to this self-contained community?
Yes. Well, of course, by that choice, of course, you make me feel a little sad because there's no way in which any planner can ever build a new community which has this historical richness. I mean, one thinks about the variety of Sicilians and Italians who occupy South Philadelphia, or even the variation in blacks. Our assumption that blacks are a uniformity, of course, is an illusion. There is no way in which a new town, one can ever create this from start. It takes a long, long period of time. And I suppose that's why all new towns, wherever they have been built, have been rather bland. This new town was designed for a single developer, oil, gas, multimillionaire, who plans to build a necklace of cities in the oak piney woodlands around Houston, Texas. And this was the first of these. He had 80,000 acres from which to select 20,000 acres for the new town. And it's very, very beautiful land, but it's very, very difficult to develop. And that's the reason it has only, there has not been very, very much development. The factors there were... the most critical ones were really how to develop an area which had a water table on or near the surface and very, very difficult soils. Soils that became almost horrifying mud with a little rainfall. And, of course, the reason the area was beautiful was because the soils were so clay and the water table was so near the surface. This forest contains willow oaks, 250-foot-high water oaks, yaupon, a very rich and beautiful environment. And, of course, the rest of Houston is a basin which used to be a prairie without any relief and only woodlands in stream corridors. So it was a dramatic environment about 30 miles away from Houston, eminently desirable and such an extraordinary contrast to the rest of metropolitan Houston, but difficult to build in because the traditional method of building was to draw down the water table by digging ditches. Of course, by drawing down the water table, you destroy the environment which caused these plants to be there, and of course they died. But if you're a short-term developer, you didn't care, you see, because you could build the buildings, sell them, and get out before the trees died. But somebody wanted to build a new town, obviously couldn't do that, and somebody wanted to get $50 million from HUD Title VII money clearly couldn't do that. So for that sort of study, we had to, in fact, invent a way in which we could accomplish drainage without despoiling the environment which George Mitchell wanted to sell to people at high prices. And this really was our discovery.
Was that, in fact, possible?
Oh, it was possible. Something God had invented a long while ago, and which civil engineers, of course, had forgotten about. It's called natural drainage. But it meant leaving very, very large areas adjacent to watercourses, which would, of course, be occupied by water when flood occurred. And by ensuring that everything that was designed, I mean, fairways, foundations of homes, roads, every single one of these were designed in such a way as to deflect the water to shallow areas where that water would then be recharged into the ground. And it really isn't, isn't all that terribly clever. But it was novel, and it was, of course, suspect, but of course it worked like a charm.
Would you ever recommend to a client that they don't build, that they should just give up and move somewhere else?
Yes, indeed. I have done for many, many clients, yes. Either the environment, the natural environment is intolerant, or the social environment is intolerant. We've advised a number of clients that Aspen at the moment is not really a very good place to build because, there is very reasonable resentment about the amount of building that actually has occurred. We are actually... having trained and given succor to people who were adversary conservationists, we now find ourselves in a situation of confronting these as governors and chairman of planning commissions. They've learned their lesson well.
What do you think of a place like Los Angeles, which is basically a desert that is now covered with lush greenery because there's water being piped in? It seldom rains, but when it does rain, it rains a lot and for a long time.
Well, Los Angeles and San Francisco offer such extraordinary examples of human stupidity. You don't have to be a geologist to know that these rocks are fundamentally unstable, and yet year after year that we have these mudslides, we have movie stars' houses falling down slopes. Of course, it's perfectly comprehensible. It's perfectly predictable, as a matter of fact. I once did a study for San Francisco Metropolitan Region in which we inherited $4 million of beautiful geohydrologic data developed by the United States Geological Survey, in which identified the San Andreas Fault, the Humboldt Fault, but also identified the probability of landslides, from very, very high probabilities, really almost assured landslide areas to areas where there's a very high probability. One could see, of course, that building had been random with respect to these. The same is true with areas which were sensitive to seismic activity. It so happens that crystalline rock, if you build in crystalline rock and have good foundations, the building will ring like a tuning fork and windows will fall out, but the building will not fall down. But if you build in San Francisco and the most recently filled sediments, either the natural sediments of the bay or man-made fill in the bay, these are absolutely perilous because every little grain of sand buffers every other thing. So there's a continuous movement which simply causes buildings to fall down, which will, because of ruptured gas mains, electric lines and so on, they will burn. Now, these are absolutely hazardous environments. And yet, if you look at a map of San Francisco and identify all of the facilities which you would want to have operating after an earthquake. You obviously want to have VA hospitals and general hospitals, old people's homes and kindergartens and electrical substations and so on. You would like to have these not on a San Andreas and Humboldt Fault, but that's not the case. The opposite seems to be true, as if some diabolical planner chose all the areas where you would want to avoid hazard, kindergartens, creches, churches and so on. These seem to concentrate on these faults, and it's absolutely diabolical. And of course, of all the things, this great father of the hydrogen bomb, this venerated putrescence, Dr. Edward Teller, who was unhappy about Los Alamos's dragging its feet about building a hydrogen bomb and insisted that Congress give him the opportunity of building another new and expensive lab in Livermore. Where did this man put the bloody lab? He put it right on top of a fault zone. Can you imagine anything diabolical as designing a hydrogen bomb and doing all of this testing in an area which is over a seismically active area?
Now that Los Angeles and San Francisco are built up, what kind of recommendations would you make, or is it just too late to undo the damage?
Well, it would be appropriate now to decide that there are certain areas where there's a greater hazard to life and health and others. And it would be, I think, wise to recognize that a lot of very sensitive facilities are on these faults and terribly vulnerable should there be an earthquake. I mean, it seemed to me a first plan would be to ensure that all the kinds of emergency facilities you need for an earthquake are not, in fact, going to be the first victims of that earthquake. Then the other would be to identify all the areas where there is a hazard to life and health, areas which are particularly vulnerable to any seismic activity, and prohibit development there. You know, God, that seems, doesn't it seem so infantile? I mean, why should a grown man have to make such an expostulation? But the fact of the matter is that there is no planning which prohibits development in areas which are a hazard to life and health anywhere.
Now, what about places that are near a nuclear reactor?
Well, that's a man-made diabolical circumstance, and a really very, very serious one indeed. I view with great apprehension, you know, Limerick, which is growing in size, and I think I'm within its malevolent radius. I know, what does one do about it except not live near the damn things? And of course, if one could turn around and not build them, this would be even better. Or if you build them, certainly build them as far away as possible from concentrated human habitation.
There's a growing problem now of toxic dumps for toxic waste. How is that affecting you as an architect?
Well, as a landscape architect, nobody's asked me to do anything about it. Presumably there are ways in which we can find areas which are safe for hazardous waste. Anyway, safer. But as far as I can see now, there really are no procedures whatsoever for making such analysis. My wife and I have a certain personal interest in this matter because we live within a few miles of a Strasbourg dump, which was a modest little municipal dump. I mean, beer cans and bed springs and all of these, you know, benign things, which suddenly, without any forewarning whatsoever, the state of Pennsylvania licensed to be a dump for hazardous waste. Now, there's no custodian, there's no fence, there's no manifest procedure, there's no testing. So anybody with any malevolent, you know, stuff may come to that dump and dump the stuff with impunity. It's absolute outrage. Nobody in the first case did any analysis, to the best of my knowledge, to determine whether this would be safe or not. And at the hearing in the Chester County Courthouse, the proponent said that society didn't have to worry because he was going to put a liner between this hazardous waste and the environment. And he held up the liner. Everybody's recognized this, a hefty bag. You know how good hefty bags are. You take one of these things and put in a few bottles and rattle them around and you see them ruptured. So the idea of society being protected from some of the most lethal wastes in the world by, you know, a piece of mylar is utterly ludicrous. But of course, if one did this seriously, you could identify areas where there's the greatest possible isolation. I mean, there are salt domes, there are massive granitic rocks and so on, which don't have groundwater resources. I'm sure it is perfectly possible for society to be able to deal with. But I think a much better method is not to make the assumption that municipalities should absorb this waste at all. It seems to me the burden rests with the people who produce these wastes. And if the wastes are so fearfully lethal, the real question is whether or not society needs the products which produce these lethal byproducts. But the idea of a tiny little town like Newland Township, you know, being bankrupt, having to hire a scientist and hire a lawyer in order to protect himself against great operations from surrounding states dumping lethal waste, I think is an outrage.
Do you feel that as an architect you have more clout in arguing this?
You keep calling me an architect.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my goodness. No, don't want to become an architect or be one. No, I'm a landscape architect and regional planner. More clout. Well, I think clout is a function of information, and about the only thing people like me really have to employ is information. By and large, we find that the information about how any system works is generally not known to citizenry anywhere. And that is particularly offensive because the fact of the matter is an enormous amount of this information now does exist. I have done innumerable studies in different parts of this country where I have been able to have access to people and to published information, been able to put together a fairly good first formulation about how a natural system works. And I find on these occasions when my scientific colleagues and I make presentations to people, wherever it is, an errant Scotsman out of Philadelphia going to the Puget Sound knows more about this environment than the people who live there. And you see, I think this is outrageous. Somehow we have got to be able to deal with this in a way that an educated person living in a city knows about the environment and knows what the implications are of the management of that environment on his, her health and well-being and of his, her children. And the fact of the matter is this knowledge is not disseminated in the schools or colleges or universities, and most people are entirely ignorant about the natural environment as a system, and in particular about the natural environment they themselves occupy.
What would your critique be of Philadelphia as a city and its integration of land and natural resources and industry and homes and buildings?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say was the choice of a city was an inspired one. I mean, the man who did this, William Penn, was a very, very clever man indeed. And I think this particular location in Delaware, that particular location in Schuylkill, that access, all of this was absolutely inspired. Foundations were very, very good. The drainage was absolutely wonderful. The hydrology, transportation corridors, access up the Schuylkill. This was really absolutely inspired. I think the first plan was a perfectly good 18th century plan. Some of the major statements made within that plan, I think, are also inspired. Certainly the Wissahickon and Fairmount Park is, without equal in the rest of the world. This is a park which goes from really quite wild. You know, the paths of the Wissahickon and Cresham are remarkably wild. I've seen lots of deer, now that's extraordinary within a city. The sadnesses, I think, are the 19th century part of Philadelphia, and in particular the treatment of the waterfront. You know, Philadelphia has 22 miles of frontage in the Delaware River. And how noble and magnificent that must have been. I mean, it is a great river. And how despicably we have treated it. We've turned our backside to the river. There used to be, I think, 193 or more piers on the Delaware. And when these were teeming, with ships, this must have been a grand sight. But this has not been true for a long while. And there are, I think, only two working piers now, the Wicker Street Terminal and one more. So the rest of this land is in dereliction, and I think that really is very tragic. I think to retrieve the Delaware should be a major objective of the city of Philadelphia. The other great things are, anybody who sees early American colonial architecture can only marvel, because this really was an outpost. It was, beyond it, and they were very, very lonely people, and yet how well they built. Peter Shepherd, Sir Peter Shepherd, who is a member of our faculty and a past president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, says that if you want to see the finest 18th century English architecture, come to Philadelphia. Go to Williamsburg. And it's true. As you look at Society Hill, Independence Hall, Carpenter Hall, the buildings were built by these people are remarkable, how fine they were. And, their general judgments about parks and open spaces and roads and, of course, domestic architecture was absolutely superb. And one can only feel very, very sad that the standards fell off so very badly in most of the 19th century and the 20th century. And the things that have been done in the latter part of the century have been heroic, and some of them very good, like Society Hill. But they really have not affected the largest part of the fabric of the city of Philadelphia, which is deteriorating at a very fast rate.
Ian McCarrick, I'd like to end by asking you what your vision of a good world would be.
Oh, I would be happy if we had a system under which we consciously, while consciously aware of the whole environment of the continental United States, with all of its variety, if it were seen that this offered limitless opportunities, for health and well-being, and an extraordinary diversity of environments and means of employment. If this whole system could be seen somehow in a national perspective, and we would make some assumptions about what might be, or what ought to be even better. Because the pattern of urbanization we have is really a legacy of being colonized from the East, and it's very much a legacy of a 19th century industry. It's not necessarily the best pattern of urbanization or the best pattern of human settlement. What might it be? And I think now is a time when there may very well be major changes, because energy is obviously moving from east to west. There is a possibility of having another thought about what the future might hold. And I would like to see this done consciously. An ecological inventory of the entire country, and a very, very elaborate identification of different constituencies, different coherent groups, and a listing from them about what their needs and desires were, what their dreams and aspirations were, and the formulation of a number of alternative futures for America, which would be subject to some public discourse and referendum, and out of which then ultimately would come a plan for the face of this great and rich and beautiful land.
That's what you'd like to see?
I would love to see it.
You think we'll see that?
Oh, who knows? I never make predictions.
Okay. Ian McCarg, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon on Fresh Air. I've been speaking with Ian McCarg, who is a landscape architect and urban planner. He is the chairman of the Department of Landscape Architecture and Regional Planner at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's also the author of the very well-known book, Design with Nature. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, we'll be talking about toxic wastes. With me will be Michael Brown, who's the journalist who broke the Love Canal story. And he's written a book about the Love Canal incident as it's developed. Joining us also will be Bruce Mulholt, who is a scientist at the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia. And he is very much informed about the toxic waste problems in the Delaware Valley area. So he will tell us about how this issue looks locally. We'll also be discussing some of the proposed legislation to deal with toxic waste. At 3:30, Fresh Air's film reviewer Bill Van Wert will be with us. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by gynecologist Dr. Niels Lauerson, who's written a book, a know-your-body type book. Also with us at that time will be Amy Brodke, who's been the doctor with the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women, a women's-run, feminist-oriented gynecological healthcare center in Center City. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can join us then. Contributing to today's show was Francis Davis. The technical director today was Joyce Lieberman. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm David Malpas with All Things Considered.
Maybe he wants to show that in art, you can draw practically anything. You can make so much unrealistic things when in real life it's impossible to be like that or do that.
Someone once said about Pablo Picasso that he couldn't fully experience an event or an idea until he had painted it, or sculpted it, or turned it into a print or a pot. Picasso was the most dynamic artistic force of this century. Today, a major exhibit of his works opened in New York. Tonight on All Things Considered, we explore the idea of Picasso.
Also tonight, these stories: South Korea's military rulers hold talks with dissidents after a wave of violent demonstrations.
President Carter gets a first-hand look at destruction caused by the volcano in Washington State.
Scientists say the blast had equivalent force of several atomic bombs.
Some merchants in riot-torn Miami are packing it in. Others say they will reopen.
Major League Baseball players prepare to go out on a call strike.
And more about gardens, old ones and new ones.
First, Richard Harris has this news.
I don't know if there's anything else like it in the world. It's an unbelievable sight.
President Carter looked down on Mount St. Helens today and was in awe of the devastation caused by Sunday's eruption. Mr. Carter flew by helicopter through thick clouds and rain and came within 2 miles of the volcano during his hour-long tour of the devastated area. Afterwards, he talked with reporters.